We are back, and I'm happy to be back to spend some quality time, just under 30 minutes or so, with all of you great Constant listeners on a fresh new episode of The Far Middle. A quick happy birthday at the start to the great Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. He's got a birthday on March 8th. That was back in 1841 when he was born. Holmes was quite the Supreme Court jurist. I'll forever be a fan of his because of the position that he took when it came to free speech and protected speech. He established the concept of speech being protected and free as the assumption or the base case, not the exception. And the only time speech should not be protected, according to Holmes, was if the speech in question was a clear and present danger. The clear and present danger test featured two independent conditions. So first, the speech had to impose a threat that was a substantive evil that would follow from it. And second, the threat had to be a real imminent one. The court had to identify and quantify both the nature of the threatened evil and the imminence of the perceived danger. That sets a really high bar to be met if speech is going to be suppressed. And that's good in a Republican democracy that values individual rights like ours. And by the way, do you know Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr.'s nickname? It was a great one, maybe one of the best ones in the history of the Supreme Court, the Great Dissenter. That's awesome. Now, this is episode 94 for The Far Middle. Our dedication may be the first that goes to a specific day in sports. I need to have our Far Middle historians check that for sure. But specifically, we're going to dedicate episode 94 of The Far Middle to the date of June 17th, 1994. So 94, 1994. That day in history may have been the most event-driven and action-packed day in the history of sports, or maybe I should say action-packed with respect to individuals or events that have a connection to sports. And let me explain by listing the events that occurred on June 17, 1994. First, a 64-year-old Arnold Palmer shot a round of 81 in the second round of the U.S. Open at Oakmont Country Club, just outside of Pittsburgh. That's about 20 minutes from where I'm recording this. So anytime you got a pro golfer posting 81 in a major, that's usually going to be viewed as a horrible showing. But Arnie Palmer was given a special exemption to appear one last time in his home state. That was his 32nd appearance at the Open. He, of course, didn't make the cut, so that was basically Palmer's swan song. Now, June 17th, 1994, also saw Ken Griffey Jr. do an amazing thing. And I don't think we ever dedicated an episode to Griffey Jr., so this can serve as one, I guess, sort of. And by the way, Griffey Jr.'s dad, Ken Griffey Sr., he's from Western Pennsylvania. He grew up around Denora, Pennsylvania, which, by the way, is the same hometown as Stan the Man Musial. And Griffey Sr. attended the same high school and school district that a guy named Joe Montana would eventually attend. So Western Pennsylvania sports history, it's about as rich as it gets around here. Anyway, on June 17, 1994, Griffey belted his 26th home run of the season in a Mariners win, and that tied him with Babe Ruth for the most home runs before June 30th, and that's a record that Griffey would break later that month. And I figured Griffey was going to break maybe Roger Maris's single-season home run record that year, but baseball went on strike in August, and Griffey was sitting at home 40 home runs at the time, so we'll never know what might have been with that instance in that season with Griffey Jr. Another big event on June 17th. Was that for the first time in history, the World Cup, the biggest sporting event in the world, was hosted by the United States. Who won that World Cup? Did any of you remember? It was Brazil. Now, the game I remember from that World Cup was Ireland versus Italy. Ireland won that match 1-0. That was played at the Meadowlands in Jersey. You had tens of thousands of very, shall we say, spirited Italian and Irish Americans, along with Italians from Italy and Irish from Ireland at that match. I remember that crowd pretty vividly. You also, on June 17, 94, the Rangers in the hockey world, they had their ticker tape parade for winning the cup that year that occurred on June 17th. The parade was tough for me to see that one because at the time the Rangers were a despised rival of the Lemieux-led Penguins. You also had on June 17, 94, the Knicks and Rockets playing game 5 of the NBA Finals. They were locked at 2 games apiece. In fact, I was watching probably Hakeem Olajuwon on TV when that game was interrupted by a news bulletin. And it was to report on what we all remember June 17, 1994 for. And it was the date of the infamous low-speed chase involving O.J. Simpson and Al Cowlings in a white Bronco throughout what seemed to be all of Southern California. And it's estimated that almost 100 million people watched that chase, which of course ended at Simpson's home in Brentwood outside of Los Angeles. And then the trial of the century phase began with that human tragedy. There's a documentary out there about June 17th, 1994. I'm not sure exactly what it's titled or where you can find it. Maybe it might have been one of those 30 for 30s on ESPN. I can't recall exactly. But I do remember it was an interesting watch, so give it a view if you haven't already. Yes, our dedication for episode 94 of The Far Middle, it goes to the day of June 17th, 1994. For me, and I'm sure many of you, it's hard to believe that was almost 30 years ago. The best and worst of sports played a prominent role to every American, whether they were sports fans or not, on that day. Time to get moving on making some connections. Okay, June 17th, 1994, that was the start of when we began to see some statements and some positions from O.J. Simpson that just didn't seem to add up. Now today, we're seeing a completely different situation where the statements and the positions are not adding up. And that pertains to the ever-expanding arena of carbon reduction commitments and pledges from businesses, and particularly here I'm talking about large global businesses. There was a study done by the consulting giant Bain that was published during the Davos conference this year, and the study was rooted in a survey of global companies in the fourth quarter of 2022, so the end of last year. And there were two key findings from the study and the survey. First finding was that less than one-fourth of the 137 companies surveyed, they plan to use carbon credits to supposedly help reach carbon reduction targets. So less than a quarter planned on doing that. The second finding was that more than 90% of the same global companies that were surveyed, they had promises in place to cut net greenhouse gas emissions to zero by 2050. Those two results expose a serious math problem and an epic fallacy. First, understand it's going to be impossible for a global corporation to reach absolute zero carbon emissions in 2030 or 2040 or 2050 for that matter. And I'm speaking from a scopes 1 through 3 life cycle basis of emissions, which is the perspective, of course, that one needs to measure carbon dioxide emissions when assessing carbon footprint, because the atmosphere doesn't care whether the carbon dioxide is emitted upstream or downstream from a business's direct activity. An emission of carbon dioxide is an emission to the atmosphere, no matter where in the life cycle or the supply chain, direct or indirect. All business and economic activity in this world has a carbon footprint on a life cycle, scopes 1 through 3 basis. And global corporations, they've got an exceedingly massive carbon footprint when you do the accurate accounting math. It's a dirty little secret across corporate America and global corporations that when they speak of carbon footprint, they're only assessing their scopes 1 carbon footprint, which essentially ties to their direct activities. They often conveniently ignore upstream and downstream activity carbon footprints of their business model or their supply chain, which results in drastically understating carbon dioxide emissions and carbon footprint for a whole host of industries and corporations across the globe. Okay, now with that side note sort of recorded in the far middle history, let's get to how these two survey results expose the math problem and the fallacy. So if there is no global corporation today that can posit or demonstrate that they are absolute zero carbon footprint, or will be soon, then the only way to get to zero carbon footprint would be on a net basis after you deduct or credit your carbon footprint with offsets from other sources, which basically means buying offsets from the carbon credit market. A corporation buys its way to a net zero or a net lower carbon footprint by participating in what looks to be a modern-day form of religious indulgences. The global corporation pays for its sin of energy utilization and carbon footprint by doing what? By buying credits or indulgences to wipe away the sin. And instead of a religion or church or religious head who is the one that is financially benefiting from the sale of the indulgences, today, you have global organizations more like the United Nations or the World Bank or the IMF that would be benefiting by providing markets and platforms and methodologies to transact in carbon credits. So the survey of these global corporations found on one hand that 90%+ of them have pledges to get to zero carbon by 2050. And again, that has to be on a net zero carbon, not absolute zero carbon basis, because of those pesky laws of physics and chemistry that we just discussed. But on the other hand, the same companies in that survey, or at least more than 75% of them, said they have no current intention to purchase carbon credits. And those carbon credits are the only way the global corporation, such as the ones in the survey, would have a hope of achieving net zero carbon by 2050. Again, assuming they are doing the legitimate carbon accounting of a life cycle, scopes 1 through 3 basis. The only conclusion a logical assessment is going to reach is that the 137 global corporations in the survey are not going to have a chance in Hades of reaching even net zero carbon footprint by 2050 unless they rush to purchase massive amounts of carbon credits on whatever exchange they can find them on. And those carbon credits will become prohibitively expensive as the demand for them increases. In other words, there are only one or two possible outcomes to this situation. Outcome number one is that indeed the vast majority of global corporations never end up purchasing significant levels of carbon credits, in which case none of them are going to be absolute carbon zero, and very, very few of them will manage to be even net carbon zero by 2050. Zero carbon by 2050, under this scenario, is an absolute sham, but I'm guessing that the current boards of directors and CEOs of those global corporations, they don't plan on being in their jobs by the time 2050 rolls around. It's just a guess, constant listeners. I can't tell for sure. Outcome number two is that if some of these 137 global corporations, they really do wish to at least be able to say that they are net carbon zero by 2050, well, they're going to need to get to work to purchasing serious amounts of carbon credits across different trading platforms. And that is going to be very expensive, quite an expensive proposition, because sin, when it comes to the world of carbon emissions in the religion of environmentalism, it comes with a very expensive penance. Now, who ends up paying for all those carbon credits in the end? Of course, the same people who always end up paying under these types of government-mandated and environmentally manufactured schemes. You've got consumers who are going to pay through higher prices for the goods or services from the corporation that had to purchase the carbon credits. You'll have the middle class and working poor who are going to pay because higher costs for goods and services. That ends up stoking inflation, which is disproportionately going to fall on the shoulders of those economic demographics. And you're going to have shareholders of these companies suffer as well because the cost of the credits reduce profitability of the company that the shareholder owns an interest in. And of course, the taxpayer will end up suffering as well, because all of this carbon credit trading and the new religion of environmentalism and its indulgences, it comes with a lot of regulatory and government bureaucracy. Someone's got to manage all that stuff, right? And who's going to pay for it? The taxpayer. So there you have it, constant listeners. The reality of carbon zero pledges by 2050 from global corporations is pretty straightforward. No one's going to be carbon zero from an absolute perspective. That defies science because global corporations in all industries have massive life cycle carbon footprints, and a few global corporations might end up being net carbon zero by purchasing massive amounts of carbon credits, but the cost of their good or service is going to skyrocket because carbon credits are not going to be cheap. And most of these corporations, they have no hope and may have no intention of ever becoming even net carbon zero by 2050. But saying so in 2023 is a feel-good proposition to fit in with the cool crowd, and you never have to worry about backing up what you're saying because you, as a director or as a chief executive, you'll be long gone by the time 2050 rolls around. And aside to this discussion of the Davos Global Corporation Survey actually serves as our next connection. We've been talking about carbon credits, but we haven't discussed whether the efforts and activities that lead to the generation of a recognized carbon credit actually benefit the environment. Everybody assumes that if you get an activity or other endeavor designated by a regulatory body or an objective environmental assessor to be eligible as creating a carbon credit, that it should be something that greatly benefits the environment and helps to tackle climate change. Well, NASA, along with UC Irvine, recently performed a study of satellite imagery across 10 years of carbon credit projects in California. And that study found that those projects provided no real climate benefit. Now, that's coming from a scientific agency of the federal government and a university from the great state of California, not exactly what you would consider climate change skeptics. And certainly, you would consider them to be huge advocates and in many ways originators of the carbon trading concept. So recognizing that many of these carbon credits are backed by activities that aren't actually benefiting climate is only going to make the math problem that we just discussed more challenging, and it makes the charade even more absurd. Yes, fact versus fiction and reality versus image. sort of reminds me of that Bono lyric. Was that Sunday Bloody Sunday where he said, where fact is fiction and TV reality? I think that was Sunday Bloody Sunday. Anyway, these contrasts, they loom large when it comes to climate change and climate policies. And unfortunately, some of our most esteemed institutions in the field of science, they surrendered the fact and the reality in exchange for the fiction and the image. An example of this serves as our next connection. And this is something that I've been meaning to discuss with you constant listeners for a number of months now. It's been in the hopper for a while. I'm happy to finally be able to get to it. This comes from an article in Scientific American, which, by the way, is a magazine that I used to read as a young adult. What I'm about to read you shows how much things have changed when it comes to sort of the approach and the style of the content in Scientific American. Now, the title of the article from last year was, "We are living in a climate emergency and we're going to say so." That was the title of the article. Let me read you some of the sections of this article. First, quote, "Given the circumstances, Scientific American has agreed with major news outlets worldwide to start using the term climate emergency in its coverage of climate change," end quote. The article goes on, quote, "This idea is not a journalistic fancy. We are now on solid scientific ground. In January, Scientific American published an article about a study entitled World Scientists Warning of a Climate Emergency. Journalism should reflect what science says. The climate emergency is here," end quote. Now, those were the sections of the article that were of most interest. But the second thing that was of ironic interest was at the very end of the article, here is what appeared in text. "This is an opinion and analysis article." That's right. One of the preeminent scientific publications in America publishes an article declaring faith to the religion and to the ideology by saying it is all based in fact and scientific certainty. And then at the end, they declare that it's an opinion piece. It's another institution of science that has succumbed to the science. You know, watching the slippage of scientific integrity in the context of climate change over the years, it's actually impacted my views on a whole bunch of other issues far afield or completely unrelated from atmospheric CO2. And one of those issues is with respect to, of all things, the death penalty, which brings us to our next connection. I used to be a proponent of the death penalty. I was eye for an eye, Old Testament type of an approach, how I viewed that. But then the more I studied it, the facts and the data, they started to overwhelm my position. So whether it is DNA evidence that exposes that the person who has been charged is actually innocent or just old-fashioned mistake of the wrong perpetrator, when it comes to the death penalty, there are no do-overs. If you execute the wrong person who's innocent, it's the wrongful taking of an innocent life, which is ironic, sadly ironic, because it's the same crime the innocent individual was on trial for or accused of. Now, there is a significant degree of uncertainty in many death penalty cases, even though the consensus of a jury or the public in a high-profile case might be that the accused is indeed guilty. So I've evolved into more of a life-in-prison advocate for convicted murder instead of the death penalty, unless the accused freely admits to the killing or somehow they're caught in the act itself, they're on tape or something like that. Now, I came across a real-life example of this that I wanted to share with you. It involves a serial killer in London in the 1940s and 1950s by the name of John Reg Christie. Now, Christie murdered at least 8 people, including his own wife eventually, and he disposed of the bodies in his small backyard or behind the walls of his flat, which was in London in Notting Hill. And his address was 10 Rillington Place. That became the title of a famous movie that was made about Christie. The lead role of Christie was played by British acting great David Attenborough, who most of us know by his role in Jurassic Park later in his career. By the way, Jurassic Park, written by the great author Michael Crichton, who we have discussed on prior episodes of The Far Middle. But give that movie, 10 Rillington Place, a watch if you get a chance. It's a great movie, very suspenseful. Anyway, the most fascinating aspect of these heinous acts that was performed by Christie was that the husband of one of the victims of Christie, the husband was a gullible, impressionable, a little bit of an unstable man, his last name was Evans, who Christie duped into being set up and at first admitting to the crime of murdering his own wife. He got Evans to actually admit that he murdered his own wife, even though he didn't. And Evans and his family, his wife and young child, they lived upstairs in the flat of Christie's, and they were basically rent-paying tenants of Christie's. And at the husband's trial, when he was on trial for murdering his wife, he had by then recanted his admission of performing the murder of his wife, but it wasn't enough to sway the judge or the jury. Christie, by the way, was a key witness testifying against Evans at his trial, and Evans was condemned to death for killing his wife and his young child. This was before anybody knew that Christie was a serial killer, and his last-minute appeals failed, and Evans was eventually hung in 1950, and then following the law, Evans was buried on the prison grounds. Now, down the road, Christie was eventually found out as the true murderer of the executed tenant's wife and also the murderer of Evans's young child and obviously his other victims of Christie, including, as I said, Christie's own wife eventually. And he ended up killing, Christie did, four more women after the wrongly accused Evans was executed. So he continued killing even after they executed the wrong man. And the controversy around Evans and his hanging after all this came out, it became a major contributor to the eventual abolition of capital punishment in the UK. Evans was pardoned in 1966 after, of course, he was executed, and his remains were exhumed from the prison graveyard and moved to a private burial plot by his family. The execution of Evans was not officially recognized as wrongful, though, until 2003. Now, as I said, the movie 10 Rillington Place is highly recommended. When it comes to capital punishment, consensus, that's not going to be enough. That's not going to suffice. There are no undoings for a mistake or getting it wrong. A civil society should require certainty by either the scientific variety or by the accused free admission. Now, there's a detail I just mentioned regarding the serial killer Christie and the wrongfully executed Evans that leads us into our next connection. I mentioned that when Evans was hung, he was then buried on the grounds of the prison. And then years later, when he was pardoned after death, his remains were exhumed and moved to a private burial plot. It reminded me of one of the most bizarre situations ever when it comes to human remains. And that would be the story of what happened to Evita, or Eva Perón's remains after she died at the young age of 33. Now, I've sat through the musical Evita more times than I care to admit, constant listeners. One of my daughters back in the day was the high school musical producer, and Evita was the performance for one of those years. So I'm not going to end up singing for you on this episode, Don't Cry For Me, Argentina. And I'm not going to weigh in as to whether the Perón regime was good or bad, but I do want to discuss what happened to Evita after her death from cervical cancer. She died in 1952, around the same time Christie was committing murder at 10 Rillington Place in London. In the immediate days that followed her death, eight people, just to put this in perspective how popular Evita was in Argentina, eight people were crushed to death, and 2,000 people were treated at hospitals for injuries in the mob's rush to get near her body in Buenos Aires. So she was given a massive state funeral and an ornate mass. And then there was a public viewing of her body in rest about 10 days after that. Now, here's where it gets really weird. Evita was embalmed, and the plan was to build a memorial for her that was going to be, get this, larger than a Statue of Liberty. Evita would be placed at the base of the memorial and be in public view afterward, sort of similar to what they did with Lenin in Russia. And while the monument was being built, Evita's body sat in her former office for 2 years. And before the monument was completed, her husband, Juan Perón, was overthrown. He fled the country, and he left Evita's body behind. And the new regime removed Evita's body, and it disappeared for 16 years. Now, in 1971, you fast forward, Argentina found out that Evita's body was buried in a crypt in Milan, Italy, of all places. The corpse had been disfigured and damaged, probably during its transport to Italy. And at that time, Juan Perón had remarried, and he had Evita's body flown to his new home in Spain, and he and his wife at the time decided to place the corpse in the dining room on a platform near the dining room table. So maybe you think that attending a dinner at the Perón's would be a bit interesting during those days? I'm guessing that it would be. Now, Juan Perón eventually returned to Argentina and became president once again, and after his death, Evita's corpse was returned to Buenos Aires for burial. Thus ended the saga of the burial of Evita, or Eva Perón. At least we hope. It has to be one of the strangest stories about a funeral and burial that you will ever hear. Closing time is here for episode 94, The Far Middle. This episode's been a really interesting one, sort of unconventional on some of the topics that we covered, but it's been a lot of fun. I hope you enjoyed it. And we've been discussing maybe some darker topics like the OJ murder trial and serial killers in London and lost bodies in Argentina and so on. And it sort of reminds me of a game from my youth that I'm guessing many of you enjoyed playing as well. The game was Clue. That's a true classic. Colonel Mustard with a knife in the billiard room type of stuff. Endless hours of fun with family and friends, the type of fun that it seems like kids and families these days don't have any interest in engaging in, unfortunately. And one of these days, I'm going to write a piece, I think, on the greatest board games of all time. That would be a fun exercise to engage in and to receive your feedback on. I guess I'll add it to the list of things to do, I suppose. Anyway, what I wanted to close with is not so much the board game Clue, but instead the movie that was adapted from the board game in 1985. And the name of the movie, not surprisingly, was Clue. And Clue fielded what I consider to be an all-star cast of actors. So just check out this lineup. You had Tim Curry as the butler. And Curry, I think, is a genius actor. I love him in the Rocky Horror Picture Show. He was awesome as well in Clue. And he claims that Clue was one of his favorite films, by the way. You had Madeleine Kahn. She played a great role, as did Leslie Ann Warren. Leslie Ann Warren was a last-minute replacement, by the way, for Carrie Fisher in that movie, who was dealing with addiction issues before the shoot. So she had to drop out. She was going to play the role of Miss Scarlet. And here's something that you don't see in most movie casts. Its three main female suspects were played by Eileen Brennan, Madeleine Kahn, and Leslie Ann Warren. And all three of them were Academy Award nominees for Best Actress in a Supporting Role at different points in their careers. You had Christopher Lloyd in the movie. He was awesome as Professor Plum. You had Martin Mull, and again, as I mentioned, Eileen Brennan. They've just stacked more talent onto what was an already deeply talented cast. And by the way, there is a cameo in Clue by Jane Wiedlin of the Go-Go's. She plays the singing telegram lady toward the end of the movie. Now, the movie was not a box office success, and it barely broke even, and it had sort of very mixed reviews from critics. But it seemed to have developed a very strong cult following after its release through the years, and I am certainly a member of that cult following. I think the movie was quite innovative. You had multiple alternative endings by film's end. You had great writing, a lot of nuanced one-liners and innuendo that kept you paying close attention throughout the movie. And another reason I love this movie was that in many ways it paid homage to classic Agatha Christie tales. You know, you got murder, whodunit, dinner guests, big mansion at night, lots of twists and turns. And as we've discussed in prior episodes of The Far Middle, I am a lifelong avid reader of Agatha Christie. So while I am not Professor Plum with the lead pipe in the billiard room, I am your host, Nick DeOlias, with another episode of The Far Middle coming at you in a week. Till then, be good.